Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 24th of October, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with singer Kathleen Wayne about her performance during next Saturday's Festival of Russian Culture. We'll find out how you can help local families in need by contributing to the St. Vincent de Paul Thanksgiving Basket Program. We'll interview Joel Upton, author of Bering Sea Blues, about the dangerous world of king crab fishing. We'll also talk to people about the goings-on with the Juneau Lyric Opera. And we're here writing out Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like rain likely with the low temperatures around 40 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, more rain with high temperatures around 45 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, more rain with high temperatures around 44 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native youth suicide is addressed in Alaska. An oversight field hearing on the issue was held Saturday at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. The hearing took place in conjunction with the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention, which wrapped up Saturday. Thousands from both rural and urban communities were in attendance. According to those in the field, Alaska has the highest rate of suicide per capita in the country. In the past decade, Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics reports Alaska Native men between 15 to 24 have the highest rate of suicide among any demographic in the country. National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez wraps up her special report.
The HOPE hearing, Helping Our People Engage, was held during the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention. U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski convened the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing. She says it was important to hold it during AFN.
The issue of youth suicide amongst Alaska Natives, and particularly young Alaska males, is one that has really gripped the attention of the state, but for the Alaska Native community, it is something that has really caused devastation. And it is in all corners of the state. Our statistics are ones that we don't like to be reminded of. But you can't run from the statistics, because behind each number is a person, is a family, is a friend. And we've got an obligation to do what we can to try to make a difference.
The focus of the hearing was to examine links to Native youth suicide, like domestic violence, child abuse, alcohol abuse, or loss of culture. Federal, state, and local witnesses testified, including Yvonne Peter, a wellness director. Peter says before change can happen, they need to identify and acknowledge what the problem really is.
I'm hoping that, you know, this attention on the issue allows us to, you know, find support in one another and really empower us to have the strength and courage to reach out to other leaders and other youth and other elders and say, hey, it's time for all of us to step up to the plate, because we all need to be a part of the solution, because the solution really rests within, you know, our families, within our villages, our tribes, and our communities. That means all of us have to be a part of this. You know, it can't be dependent on one or two people that are trying to run a program.
A community dialogue was held after the hearing for AFN delegates to share their thoughts. For National Native News, I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
An ex-DC lobbyist will have to share profits from his new book with Native tribes. Earlier this month, a federal court issued a decision to garnish the profits from Jack Abramoff's new book, titled Capital Punishment: The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyists. The federal order will help to pay some of the $22.7 million still owed to victims of the case, which consisted mostly of tribal nations. In 2006, Abramoff pleaded guilty to 3 felony counts and was later sentenced to pay $23 million and serve time in jail. During this month in 2006, Flags of Our Fathers premiered across the country in close to 2,000 theaters. October 20th marked the debut of the film featuring the story of World War II Pima veteran Ira Hayes, who was born on the Gila River Indian Nation in Arizona. This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you can get free legal help with filing a claim at meetings held around the country through December. Details and a schedule of meetings is at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guest is Kathleen Wayne. She'll be participating in the Festival of Russian Culture happening this Saturday at Centennial Hall. Kathleen, thank you very much for being in the station with us today.
You're welcome. Hi, Jeff.
So for you, we'll be singing as you are up to do here in the Capital Community here.
Yes, I'm off to do some singing this weekend with the Living Wisdom of the Far North concert. It's part of the 4th Annual Festival of Russian Culture, organized by Alexander Dolitsky. He is organizer, chair of the Alaska-Siberian Research Center. And this will be the first time I'm singing in Russian, so this will be a new experience for me. Not a new experience of singing in a language that I don't speak, however. I've done quite a lot of that, singing French, German, Italian, and even Czech, not knowing exactly what I'm talking about. But that's a part of working with a really good vocal coach, like such as Dr. John Darman, who does speak Russian, and other folks finding the coaches in the community that can help me interpret, understand what those songs are about. And for the Russian pieces, I worked with Nina Cordes, who is a Russian translator.
But you have been to Russia.
I have been to Russia. Yeah, we, Dan and I, my husband Dan, adopted two girls in Russia. And so we were in the far east part of Russia in Siberia. And we lived there for a while during the court proceedings and really fell in love with the people of Russia. It was, you know, I got to choose the pieces that I'm singing at this concert, and I really looked for pieces that had a lot of richness and a lot of feel of that Russian culture, and I picked two songs by Rachmaninoff. One is called Nepoi Krasavitsa Primenye. And it's about someone singing, saying, "Don't sing to me about the melancholy songs of Georgia," a state in Russia. It reminds me of someone I left there, reminds me of the sadness that I'm sure is on her face, etc. And it just is this meaty, just really filled with emotion and richness that I relate to my experiences of being in Russia. The second piece, again by Rachmaninoff, I can't say the Russian pronunciation, but it's Spring Waters.
But you can sure sing it.
But I can sing it. And it talks about the sentinels of spring and how we all look for the warm, lush, carefree days of summer coming right behind that beacon of the spring tide. So again, just I'm so lucky to have just an excellent pianist accompanying me. She is Tatiana Scott. She's from Sacramento, California. And she is a piano teacher down at Sacramento State. And she and I have been rehearsing through Skype. So that's been interesting. I can hear her, see her until I start singing, and then the sound blacks out. But somehow we start and stop together, and so we've been doing that a couple times a week. And she arrives here Thursday afternoon, but she is fabulous. And these pieces really require a virtuoso pianist. Rachmaninoff is far well known for his piano compositions, but these vocal piano compositions are outstanding.
How do you put yourself in the mood of a song when you don't really speak the language?
Well, and that's the challenge of finding something that speaks to me through the music, not necessarily the words. And so I worked with Dr. Damond, who suggested singing the Spring Waters song. And then I purchased a CD of Anna Netrebko, who is a Russian opera singer. And on that CD was the Nepoi Krasavitsa. And it just spoke to me, even though I didn't know what it was about, but I knew that was the song the first time I heard it.
Other than the words, what musically helps brand a song with a country?
You know, it takes a really good composer. Right now, my husband is in the process of directing La Bohème, and Puccini could do that with opera. He can create scenes where you just can hear Italian life in the background. You hear it, you feel it. You don't need to know even what the singers are saying. You feel it. Same with Rachmaninoff. I mean, again, it's just this really thick, juicy piece of music that you just feel like you're in that very lush environment.
Radio audience cannot see this, but you have a very expressive face, and I'm just wondering how much that relates to your musical training.
You know, I think it has to be inside of you for you to have it come out. Louis Armstrong says you can't play it unless you can feel it, and then you can blow it out your horn. And really, it has to be inside to have it come out. And my mom said I was singing the day I came out of the womb, and that's just been my life ever since. Singing and theater, those are two very big parts of my life.
Does the whole family sing things like Pass the Syrup?
We should do that. We should write our own opera over the dinner table. That'd be great.
Kathleen Wayne, thank you very much for coming down and talking about your singing. It's part of the Festival of Russian Culture. It starts at 4 o'clock on Saturday at Centennial Hall. Tickets are a donation of $10. If you need more information about that, Kathleen, what is that website on the bottom of the poster there?
It is www.aksrc.org.
And then see Alaska Siberian Research Center. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Come, it'll be a fabulous concert.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 24th of October, 2011. It was on this day, 1929, the U.S. stock market crashed, a day that became known as Black Thursday. 13 million stocks sold off in one day. By the next Tuesday, the market had lost almost $26 billion of value. Banks failed. Individual investors lost their savings. The Great Depression began. 1938, on this day, the Fair Labor Standards Act went into effect, which established the 40-hour work week and a minimum wage, the first effort by the federal government to regulate wages and hours for workers. It's the birthday of the Dutch naturalist and developer of the microscope, Antony van Leeuwenhoek, born in Delft in the Netherlands, 1632, on this date. He had no higher education. His father was a basket maker. He knew only one language, and that was Low Dutch. He himself made a living as a draper, and that's how he encountered his first simple microscope, a magnifying glass, used by textile merchants to check the thread counts. He learned how to grind his own lenses, and he made one that could magnify up to 200 times what you could see with the naked eye. He began to see things that no other human had ever seen, to see excrement and plaque, spit, the flesh of whales, stuff from inside eyelids, tobacco ashes, chemical solutions, phlegm, blood, the eyes of insects, pond water. It was he who discovered that millions of microbes could fit within a single grain of sand in a single sample of lake water. He never wrote a scientific paper, Leeuwenhoek, but he wrote rambling letters in which he described green algae, blood cells, spermatozoa, and bacteria. Leeuwenhoek wrote, "My work was not pursued in order to gain the praise I now enjoy, but chiefly from a craving after knowledge. It's the breast of the novelist Norman Rush, born San Francisco, 1933, served in Botswana with the Peace Corps, came back and wrote his first book called Whites. A few years later, his first novel, Mating. Norman Rush, who said, "The main effort of arranging your life should be to progressively reduce the amount of time required to decently maintain yourself so that you can have all the time you want for reading." It's the birthday of the poet Denise Levertov, born in Ilford, England, 1923, who said, "Copying something out by hand, actually forming the letters with your hand at the end of your arm, which is attached to your body, is part of the creative process." Here's a poem for today by Charles Simic entitled Brethren. A woodpecker hammers on the gutter of a nursing home where the war cripple sits in a wheelchair by the gate. The windows are wide open, but no one ever speaks here, neither about the crazy bird nor about that other war. Brethren, Charles Simic, from My Noiseless Entourage, poems published by Harcourt Incorporated, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Hi, this is Phil Smith. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, and I'm the regular host of the Monday evening program, Peace Talk. Peace Talk features recordings of important messages from leaders around the world, interviews with activists and others with something important to say, and the music of peace. That's Peace Talk this coming Monday evening at 7 o'clock here on KTOO FM.
10:17, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Tonight's program on Peace Talk is featuring Paul Carroll, who was in town here making a speech a few weeks ago. In the studio with us now is Paula Sumda from St. Vincent de Paul here to talk about Thanksgiving Day basket programs. Thank you, Paula, for coming on the show with me today.
Oh, thanks, Steph, for having us.
So, first of all, who was St. Vincent de Paul?
He was a friar. He gave to the poor. He helped with homeless and sickness, education, and made sure that everyone had food to eat. That was his goal. And everybody had a place to sleep. And in the really bad times, like when there were epidemics and stuff, they did a lot of nursing and things like that.
And how many things does the St. Vincent de Paul organization here in town do?
There's the food basket. They have the shelter. They have the thrift store. They have a daycare center. They have an after-school program for kids. So they're pretty busy. They're pretty busy. And they've expanded a lot since I came here in 1987.
And you're here to talk about today the Thanksgiving Day gift baskets that has been going on for over 9 years, from what I understand.
Yes, sir. We would like to thank everyone in Juneau for their generous giving last year. We fed over 234 families, and then even right up to the eve of Thanksgiving, people came and got food out of Rena and I's refrigerators and freezers because they had missed a deadline for the baskets. So we did a good job for Juneau, Alaska, and St. Vincent's last year. And it is that time of year again, and we're reaching out to the Juneau community for donations. And we will accept cash, of course, but any items that you personally would like to be included in a basket, such as potatoes and olives, fruit cocktail, Jell-O, canned veggies, Dream Whip, biscuits, margarine or butter, gravy mix, stuffing, turkeys, hams, or anything else you personally would enjoy. In the past, some families have even given canned bags of candy and soda for younger members of the receiving family. And we'll begin taking names for the food baskets on November 1st through the 10th. And you please come to the administrative offices of St. Vincent de Paul at 8617 Teal Street. And the phone number there is 789-5535. And that's located directly behind the Nugget Mall. Teal is the second street after the Nugget Mall. And for those wishing to donate, please call St. Vincent's at 789-5535. Or you can even fax us with your donation and how we can arrange to get that picked up at 789-2557. And St. Vincent de Paul does have a website. It's S as in Sam, V as in Victor, D as in David, P as in Paul, JUNEAU.org. So if anybody wants more information about the agency itself, they can get that online. And the baskets will be distributed November 19th, 20th, and 21st. And it will be at the River Bend Community Center right behind the post office at the housing development there. And if you need further assistance, you can call Rena Sims at 209-9993 after November 1st because she's out of town right now. And once again, we wish to thank Juneau for their kindness and caring during the holiday season. And we wish everybody a special blessing.
How do people donate? Do they,
They can make arrangements. Most people just drop it off at the administrative offices on Teal Street.
So if it's refrigerated or non-refrigerated, like canned goods?
And we do have a refrigerator there that can hold items. And if there's something that somebody would like to donate and they can't provide transportation for us for the item, we do have some people that are willing to make a drive over and pick it up for them.
Before we went on the show here today, I asked you to see if you could tell me a story about the passage of food from one family to the next.
It's amazing to watch a mom and dad and little kids come, and sometimes they even bring toys, like their old toys, and they donate everything, and then another family comes in. And the one that sticks in my mind last year was a father whose wife had died within the last 3 months before Thanksgiving, had three little children, was just making ends meet, and we delivered the items for him. And when we got there was nothing. And fortunately, I had a bag of the toys that were donated in my van. And so we were able to give those toys. Those little ones had nothing. They had three mattresses on the floor, a little tiny TV. They really didn't have anything. And Rena had just received a donation of some winter coats, and they fit the kids. And so when we left there, they had food and some toys and coats. And the dad had to go outside and just cry because he didn't know what he was going to do for the holiday. Because that was what his wife had always done, was get all the food ready and make sure everybody was, you know, warmly dressed for the winter. And he was so deeply in despair. He didn't know what to do. And so it was a really good feeling. It was really good. So I would hope that the families that do donate understand how sincerely appreciated it is. There's for the 3 days, it's like an emotional roller coaster because people come in and they're just so thankful for the food, for the items, and so appreciative that You know, you just feel like you're on this up and down and crying a lot. People are welcome to come and visit us while we're there. It's we do it from noon to 4, noon to 5 on Saturday, noon to 4 on Sunday, and noon to 5 on Monday. And anybody wants to help out, they're more than welcome to come.
Hello, I'm doing from the St. Vincent Paul. Could you give me the phone numbers one more time, please?
Certainly. The number for the administrative offices are 789-5535, and their fax is 789-2557. And thank you, really. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thanksgiving Day, with food in the shed for the winter ahead, we would gather together to say, thanks for our health, thanks for our heart, and the bounty that grows from the ground. With our loved ones near, we bless the year that's brought us safely round. Now we are shoppers, we drive to the market. The farm seems a light year away. Still every November we pause to remember that time-honored old-fashioned day. Thanks for our health, thanks for our heart, and the bounty that grows from the ground. With our loved ones near, we bless the year that's brought us safely round. Everything changes, yes, even Thanksgiving. Let's rededicate this old day to helping the hungry, the poor, and the homeless, so all may be able to say, thanks for our health, thanks for our heart, and the bounty that grows from the ground. With our love, it's brought us safely round.
Tom Chapin from UCD Mother Earth. Time is 3:28 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau, where our next guest is Joe Upton. He's the author of the book called Bering Sea Blues, A Crabber's Tale of Fear in the Icy North from Epicenter Press. Joe, thank you very much for being on the show with me today.
Hey, glad to talk to you.
So a little bit about your background, if you could tell us, please, first.
Well, I had a powerful experience when I was 18 years old. I got a job on a tender going to Alaska for the first time, and this old Norwegian mate took me under his, you know, wing and showed me what I call the ways of the North, and I've been coming to Alaska as a commercial fisherman for many years after that.
This book not only tells the personal tale of the 1971 king crab season in Bering Sea, but it also gives a good account of crab fishing in general and the king crab fisheries in particular. And without giving away all of your book, could you give us a little bit about the history of the king crab fishery?
Well, I joined it in 1971, and it was just starting to boom. You know, it had been going for about 20 years, started in Kodiak, worked out to the Bering Sea. Then in the late 60s, the first steel boats, you know, were being built, new boats. And then early 70s, you know, production was going up. You know, people were starting to realize, boy, there's a lot of money in this fishery. And then the boom years were the late 70s, and then I think it was the winter of either 1981 or 1982, it basically just collapsed. And then, luck, and many of the boats had to rethink what they were doing.
To this day, do they know why it collapsed?
You know, there's been speculation. Some people feel it was because the crabs were being handled so many times by the fleet, you know, that they were being injured. But nobody really knows. They're just theories.
How old were you when you started in the king crabbing?
I was probably 23, 24.
That's been a kind of a shock, a rite of passage.
Here's the irony, you know. We got, it was a brand new Marco boat, gorgeous boat, 104 feet, and, we left Seattle, and I thought it was just going to be a drive up to Dutch Harbor, where we would start our season, but we left Seattle in, I think it was, end of February, and basically it was a life or death struggle, going up the coast. 4 or 5 days out of Seattle, we iced up off of a place called Cape Hinchinbrook and darn near capsized. And it put such a fear in all of us, of icing up that I still remember to this day that particular night.
There's a lot of baseball bat action in the book.
Yeah. It's like if you have, here's what happened that night, okay? When I went to bed, we were steaming along and everything was okay. Little wind, not bad. And something woke me up in the middle of the night. And I lay there in my bunk and realized it's the feel of the boat. We were rolling a lot more slowly. And so I, put my clothes on and went up in the pilot house and instantly saw that we'd taken on tons of ice. And we were rolling ever so slowly, and basically when you ice up, your center of gravity rises, and if you don't do something about it, you will capsize.
Especially when you have several crab pots deep on the deck.
Yeah, no, and here's something really ironic, there's this show now called Deadliest Catch, which is, obviously it's about king crabbing, and you see these boats in the wintertime, loaded up 4 or 5, layers of crab pots. Well, in the process of writing this book, I met this guy, Bruce Whittemore, who designed all the Marco crabbers. And, the Marco boats are generally considered to be among the best steel crabbers ever built. And I said, Bruce, what is a safe load of crab pots in icing conditions? And he said to me, any more than one layer of crab pots is pushing it. So that was pretty sobering to hear that.
And you saw boats that had like 6 on them?
Oh, my goodness. Just watch Deadliest Catch. You see some of these guys going out there with, 4 or 5 layers of crab pots. It's fine if there's no ice, but the thing is, if you get out there, icing happens really quickly sometimes. And then you can't. If you're in deep water, you dump the crab pots over, they don't come back, you'll lose them. So, yeah, just watch the show sometime. You'll see some risky behavior.
Now, your skipper helped design the Marco boat that you were on. Is that true?
Yeah, this guy, Bruce Whittemore, he was the designer of all the Marco crabbers.
What about the Marco boats that makes them as unique?
Well, I wouldn't say they're, unique. They were just considered, by fishermen in the fishery to be, basically a superior design. Just for instance, okay, these boats have, you've got wooden planking about a foot over the actual deck, or 8 inches. So, and the wooden planking is what you walk on. It gives you, better traction, et cetera. But in the Marco boats, back in the stern, the steel, tank that is the lazarette, it's kind of an air tank back there, it comes up, there's no wooden decking, it comes up to that level of the wooden decking just to give you, a few, more cubic feet of extra buoyancy.
What forces combine to create the climate in the Bering Sea?
Basically you have the you know, weather systems that come up from the North Pacific, and then you have weather systems that come down from Siberia, and then you have the tides, you know, rushing in and out of the Aleutian Islands, and it's just basically a nasty place, and you don't get much good weather there, put it that way.
And it sounded like you could sit back and enjoy the view.
but I tell you what, I mean, something very dramatic. The volcanoes there were then and continue today to be active, and it wasn't uncommon, you know, especially at night, you know, you're fishing on deck and your hood's up and your field of vision is very narrow, and then one of your crewmates might pat you on the shoulder and say, look, and you would look over and one of these volcanoes would have just burped, you know, ash and lava and fireworks, you know, 20 or 30,000 feet into the sky. It was just an amazing, you know, and it was not uncommon.
Can you describe the process of crabbing in general?
Well, basically, the pots are huge. Some people call them cages. They're, you know, the most common is 6.5 feet by 6.5 feet by perhaps 30 inches high. They weigh about 700 pounds. Each one has, you know, a buoy line, maybe 400 feet of 13/16 buoy line, and then three heavy buoys. You prospect by putting these crab pots on the bottom, and then by picking them up, you get a sense of where the crab are, and then obviously you put your crab pots where the crab are. And in the days when I was fishing, there was a huge body of crab. I mean, and what we discovered was that crab segregate themselves by size and sex, and that if you were prospecting, you would find that, oh, here's the small females are over here, and then the small males are there. But once you found the large males and you could keep your gear on them, that's all you'd get. And I mean, in the fall, we were fishing in the, what they call the south side. I don't think they fish there any, you know, in modern days. You know, south of the Aleutians in very deep water. And we got into fishing so heavy that these crab pots were coming up with the meshes bulging. I mean, 2,000 pounds of crab to a pot. But what was eerie was you could not take those crab out and put them back in without crushing some. There's some herd instinct that made them, you know, crowd themselves into the pots. We would stand on deck when these pots came up, looking down into the water and wondering, you know, how many feet deep was this herd of crab on the bottom. It was an amazing experience.
I'm talking to Joe Upton. He's the author of several books, and one in particular, Bering Sea Blues, is what we're talking about now. It's published by Epicenter Press. And Joe, besides the money, what possessed you to enter that particular workforce?
Well, you know, after my first season in Alaska, I just, you know, I was working on a boat, and I wanted to come back in my own boat. Well, a few years later, I leased a boat, and it turned out to be a piece of junk. The engine blew up. I couldn't get to Alaska. I spent all my money. And I had this burning desire to, you know, to go up north and go fishing. Well, luckily this crab job came up, and I made enough money on the, you know, crabbing to get a salmon boat and spend many years salmon fishing in southern Alaska. But after the crab season, my skipper said, hey Joe, he says, next year, you know, if you want to come back, you can be like relief skipper, and then maybe, you know, after that, you know, if things go well, you know, we'll help you buy a boat. What do you think? And I said, George, I am so out of here. I was done with the Bering Sea.
And you went back to Southeast Alaska to fish?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I fished in Southeast for many years, and I loved it. I mean, it's so different from the Bering Sea. And what's ironic now is that many people who go to Alaska, who go to the Bering Sea, that's all they see. They don't realize that there's Southeast Alaska where it's nice, where there's trees, you know, where you can anchor up, where you can have a reasonable life.
Joe, whenever I read a memoir like this, do you keep a diary of sorts as you're during the travels?
When I was fishing in Southeast, I actually kept a logbook in like a logbook on the boat, and is, you know, I would write what we caught each day, but I'd try to write a paragraph or two each night about what happened. I wish I had kept a more detailed diary when I was crabbing.
You encourage other people to try your follow your career?
Well, I think if you can get on a crab boat, great. But I tell you, if you like being a human forklift, it's fine. But it's not particularly good work, or it's not particularly fun work. Put it that way.
The book is peppered with numerous photographs that show pictures of not only your boat but also the process of crabbing in general. Where do you get all those pictures? Did you take them yourself?
I took a lot, and then my friends at Trident Seafoods put me onto some pictures, and I got some pictures from Marco. I kind of collect old photographs.
Have you ever seen The Perfect Storm?
Yeah, I have seen it. And I mean, here's the thing. It's like these movies like The Perfect Storm and Deadliest Catch, in my view, they portray fishermen in an unfavorable light. I mean, on the crab boat I was on, we didn't drink real heavy. We were pretty professional people, and
Cool. I've been talking to Joe Upton, author of the book Bering Sea Blues. It's available on Epicenter Press. Is there anything you'd like to add before we sign off here?
No, but thank you for having me on, and one last little story. Okay, our skipper, he had a toothpick hanging from the top of the wheelhouse. And when the pills wouldn't keep him awake and the coffee wouldn't keep him awake, he'd stick that toothpick in his mouth, and when he nodded off, it would stab him in the cheek and wake him up.
He also had a habit of smoking cigarettes.
Oh, and one more thing. He had a mahogany cigarette pack holder on in front of the steering wheel, so when he pulled out one pack of cigarettes, the next pack would drop down into place.
And he lit up a cigarette every time a pot came up with that?
Yeah, oh yeah, every... Most pots, he'd walk back on the back deck with a fresh cigarette in his mouth.
All right, Joe, thank you very much for being on the air with me today.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bridging the gap between generations and genres is Sweet Plantain, a refreshing string quartet from New York City. Sweet Plantain fuses Western classical traditions with homegrown hip-hop, jazz, improv, and Latin rhythms for a fresh, original sound. See them in concert Friday, October 28th at the Juno Arts and Culture Center, presented by the Juno Arts and Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Arts and Westaf.
Back in the days when I was a teenager.
bit of music from the group Sweet Plantain. They're appearing this weekend in a concert brought to you by the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. If you need more information on that or would like to get some tickets, check out their website, www.jahc.org. Next in the studio, we have Laura Haywood and Sandy Fortier here to talk about things going on with the Juneau Lyric Opera. Laura and Sandy, thank you very much for being on the station with me today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So first of all, I want a Divas report.
The Divas night was spectacular, as probably most people know if they have any friends in town that went. And I just want everyone to know next year we're going to hold it in Centennial Hall, so it won't be a sold-out situation like it was this year. But it was a great fundraiser for us, and everybody had a blast.
Well, it could be sold out. You just fit more people in there.
That's true.
So what's going on now?
So our next up is Holiday Pops, and this is an annual event. We have a community chorus. Anybody can join. We just started rehearsals on Sunday. Our conductor is Sally Smith, and as she keeps saying, the more the merrier, so I'm hoping to convince people to come and join us. Our rehearsals are Sundays at Northern Light Church and in the afternoon, and Tuesday evenings at Thunder Mountain High School, and you can find all the information on our website. Sally is actually out of town right now, but she did pluck one of our favorite choral members, Sandy Fortier, to direct our next rehearsal. So, Sandy, tell us about your experiences with Holiday Pop.
Oh, well, when I first moved to Juneau 2 years ago, I got involved with Holiday Pops to get into the music community and start singing more, and this will be my third year of doing it, and I just keep getting more and more involved. Sally brings in extra instrumentalists, so I got to play flute a few times, and I get to sing, and this year I'm filling in for Sally while she's gone, and I get to conduct a few of the rehearsals, so I'm just doing more and more music nowadays.
What kind of things do you have to be aware of when you're conducting the voices?
Well, you have to make sure that the men and the women are balanced and singing at the same volume, and kind of listen to every singer and make sure that they're getting the right notes and make sure that, well, I don't know, just make sure everyone's having a good time.
Do you move people around physically or just to tell them to be quiet?
We'll see. It depends on the group, but
Tells us to get louder, in fact, because we got to sing out.
So. Yeah. A lot of people who come to this chorus seem, a lot of them are new singers or timid singers, and they don't know a lot of people. But once they get to know people, they start singing out more. So that's what I plan to do tomorrow, is just tell people to sing. And it's fun Christmas music. Everyone knows it.
Yeah, in fact, I have a sort of a short list here of some things we're doing. There's a whole medley called Christmas on Broadway. We're doing a medley called An Irving Berlin Christmas. Ding Dong Merrily on High. There's a great version of Twas the Night Before Christmas that we do every year. And then there are also sacred songs, like we're doing Coventry Carol, Joy to the World, and a wonderful combination of The First Noel and Pachelbel's Canon. We've done that a couple times, and people love it. I also want to say we want everybody, men and women, but we really especially want men. We always have a shortage of basses and tenors. And, you know, even if you've never sung before but you love Christmas music, you know, I hope that you'll come and join us. Sandy's doing some other things, too, now. Did you want
to? Yeah, Sandy's 40. Should be familiar to many of our listeners here because she's the executive director of Juneau Jazz and Classics for couple of years now, and now mm-hmm. she's moving into different pastures here.
Yeah, actually, at the end of this month, I'm going to branch off, and I'm starting a music studio, Impassion Music Studio, and working with Holiday Pops and the chorus is a good way to get started with that, and I'm going to be teaching flute, voice, and beginning piano lessons, so I'm just really excited to be able to be involved in so much music in Juneau.
And what's the name of your business again?
Impassion Music Studio. And yes. I have a website, impassionmusicstudio.com. IMPASSION.
All right. Sweeney Todd is coming up too, isn't it?
It is, but of course that's a symphony. But I'm in the chorus for that, so that's a symphony production.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
And that's this weekend. Get your tickets. They're selling fast.
All right, Laura Haywood and Sandy Fortier, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to add.
Yeah, I just want to maybe provide the details on the rehearsal. So our next one coming up is Tuesday at 6:45 p.m. at Thunder Mountain High School, and then the following Sunday at Northern Light United Church at 3 p.m. And also I should mention that the concerts are Saturday, December 10th and Sunday, December 11th. And finally, I should also mention that this costs nothing to the singer. So you get a packet of music, but you don't have to pay a registration fee.
What a deal. Is there a phone number people can call?
Yeah, you can call our office, which is 586-2742.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
This is a great way to get out and meet people and get involved in the singing community if you've ever even thought about singing. Everyone's really supportive.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. The birds' voices declare, in no uncertain terms, that autumn is once again upon us. In the golden sunlight of an October morning, a Lincoln sparrow sings energetically from a hedgerow. And soon, a fox sparrow chimes in. Both nested at higher latitudes or well up in the mountains last summer, but will spend September to May at lower latitudes or elevation. In October, massive movements of birds take place across the continent. The exodus of summer visitors to the tropics has given way to a surge from the north. The brambles twitch with sparrows. Blackbirds flock by the thousands. Bays and lakes sparkle with water birds. Loons, grebes, dabbling, and diving ducks. Many of them nested well to the north on tundra ponds. The sandpipers called dunlins now swarm south to winter along both coasts by the many thousands. Close behind are the predators, northern nesting merlins, peregrines, and sharp-shinned hawks, following south their winged prey. Follow the seasons with next year's Bird Note calendar, featuring stunning photos of the birds of Bird Note. This calendar could make a great gift for the bird lover in your life. Check it out on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
This Halloween weekend, the Juno Symphony presents the wickedly funny musical thriller Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, in a spooky concert production featuring Philippe Damerval as the revenge-seeking barber and Marta Lastufka as his insane landlady, Mrs. Lovett. Saturday, October 29th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, October 30th at 3 p.m. at JDHS. Sponsored by UAS and Alaska Pacific Bank. Tickets are at Hearthside, online, and at the door. See you at the Symphony.
Thank you.
358, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTUO on GCI Cable, Juneau on Digital Channel 871. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow, 3 on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with... Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with crafter Christina Rich, organizing a unique fundraiser. Ken Fix will be your highlight tomorrow night's planetarium presentation on Cronus and Saturn. We'll also get the details on this weekend's haunted house at the Nugget Mall. That's Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. For the forecast for tonight, rain showers likely, low temperatures around 40 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, rain increasing with high temperatures around 45 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday night, rain with low temperatures around 40 degrees. And the forecast for Wednesday and Thursday looks like rain. And Friday looks like cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau afternoon today. Have a great evening. Coming up next is All Things Considered.
Friends of the Juneau Public Libraries present Darkness on the Last Frontier, David Vann's Alaska, Wednesday, October 26th, 6 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library. Reading from the novel Caribou Island and the story collection Legend of a Suicide, Vann will tackle the complex personal and emotional themes that are part of life in Alaska: isolation, suicide, and survival. More information at juneau.org/library.